Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Cisternino here, getting you ready for our podcast tonight with Mario Lanza, talking about his new book and everything else that he is doing related to Survivor on the show today. But first, I want to take a moment and thank our sponsor for this episode of the podcast, and those are friends over at TrueCar, because when you are making a big purchase, like buying a new car, you want and expect a transparent buying process, a process that gives you the confidence to know that you're getting a fair deal. So to really understand the power of transparency, you need to check out TrueCar and TrueCar's mobile app. Because with TrueCar, not only can you configure the car that you want and how you want it, but you can see what other people are paying for the same car you're looking for down to the zip code. So you know what you can expect to pay for the car you want. Pretty transparent. And once you go ahead and decide on the car you want, you can lock in a guaranteed savings on average over $3,000 off MSRP. Then you'll be connected with a trusted True Car certified dealer that's going to honor your savings without negotiation. So when you're ready for a new, transparent car buying experience, save time, save money, never overpay, and download the True Car app today. Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Cisternino here, and we have got a fun show here today because we are going to be speaking with one of the most knowledgeable Survivor minds around, because that mind is jam-packed with all sorts of stories and all sorts of interactions with many, many Survivors, that he is the author of a brand new book called When It Was Worth Playing For. Please welcome back to the podcast our good friend, Mario Lanza.
Woo, Ian, you got my name correct. I'm very excited to be here.
Good. I actually was thinking about it today. Am I saying your last name right now?
The thing is, even people in my own family don't know how to pronounce my last name. Some say Lanza, some say Lanza, so you really can't go wrong.
What do you say?
I say Lanza.
Lanza. Okay, so Mario Lanza, here he is. And Mario has a very extensive resume. In addition to the book, he's one of the people behind the Survivor Historians podcast. He's done two versions of the Survivor Funny 115. He just did a Reddit AMA. He's everywhere, previously on Survivor. What am I missing? What am I leaving out?
You can mention that I wrote All-Star Stories back in the day, although I tend to get made fun of a lot for those nowadays. So it's up to you whether you think those are praiseworthy or mockworthy.
They're praiseworthy. They were great. I read them before I went on Survivor All-Stars. They taught me nothing. Learned nothing from them.
Glad I can help.
But they were good. They were a good read.
You should have read chapter 4, which was Watch Out for Amber.
Yeah. Anyway, so Mario, congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you. This is a long time coming. This book had a long, tortured path to ever existing in the first place, but it's been out for about 3 weeks now, and it's really doing well. I'm getting a lot of positive feedback about it, and quite frankly, there just aren't enough Survivor books out there. Yeah. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, later with the contract situation. So I'm just excited that there is a Survivor book, period, whether I wrote it or not. So that's what I think is the most exciting thing about it.
All right. Well, just tell us a little bit about what is in the book. Like, I think that there's probably a lot of confusion about what exactly did you write about in the book?
All right. So basically, the book is 470 pages about how Amber is better than Rob Cesternino at Survivor.
Duh.
No, I'm just kidding. It started as an essay I was writing for my website. People who will know me will know I have a long history with writing about Survivor. So this was basically, it just started as an essay, how I got into writing about Survivor, how just some guy who's bored at work one day starts writing about a TV show and gets an audience. And intertwined with that is a really detailed history about Survivor and, you know, the game Survivor, the phenomenon Survivor, but more importantly for me, kind of the pop cultural relevance of Survivor, how it impacted America at the time and what a big deal it was. So it's a really in-depth story that partially my story, partially the history of Survivor. And I've had, there's like 70 different essays in there about all sorts of things in Survivor that people might not know about how Richard being gay probably was the most important thing, why he won Survivor and how that impacted future seasons. Things like how Tina won Survivor by basically using the first season as a weapon against the other players.
There's talk about a couple of those things and just drill down a little bit? Well, that's very interesting to me that I don't think I've ever heard that before. Mm-hmm. Why was Richard being gay such an important reason why he won?
Yeah, this is a neat story. In fact, this is the chapter in my book called The Most Important Survivor Moment You've Never Heard Of Before. And basically, if you go back and you read, you know, one of the few Survivor books out there is Mark Burnett's book about the first season. It's called Survivor, The Ultimate Game.
Oh, I read it.
Yeah. And he, of course, you read it.
I read it when I was in college.
Yeah. But there's a really important moment in that book. And Burnett goes on and on about how, you know, Richard Hatch was destined to be the first player voted out of Survivor. Everyone hated him. He had no social skills. He was just this big blowhard. And basically what happens, and this is all documented in Burnett's book, this is just a theory I'm coming up with, that, you know, right before the first tribal council, I forget if it was night 2 or night 3, Richard kind of comes out to the rest of the tribe, mentions to everyone that he's gay, and he talks about his whole history of being gay and how he was abused as a kid, how his dad kicked him out of the house. Just, you know, this horrible story, life story that Richard led when he was a young man, and how he developed a thick skin, you know, against the world because everyone turned against him when he was young.
Yeah.
And what happened because of that speech is that the women on the tribe kind of started to rally around him. Especially, it says in the book that Kelly Wigglesworth, from that moment on, was a big protector of Richard. She wanted to protect him. So she liked him. She couldn't stand the guy before that. And after that, the whole thing with the Toggy Alliance started. And that would not have happened if Kelly hadn't been protective of Richard, if Richard hadn't kind of lowered his shell and made people see him as a human being and not just this asshole, you know, bragging about how smart he was. So, like, the fact that Richard came out of the closet before that first tribal council and everyone rallied around him, that really cemented his status within the tribe, and it made them kind of respect him a little bit. And that's an aspect of the show that a lot of people don't know about, because that is so influential of how Survivor played out. And Burnett goes on and on and on about it in his book, how important it was. But then they completely cut it out of the episode. It's not even mentioned in the Survivor episodes that Richard's gay until like an episode or two after that.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of a throwaway comment. So I just have little stories about that, about things that people might not know about the way Survivor developed and why they're important and how the show has always been much deeper than it gets credit for.
You know, since while we're here in Borneo, do you have any strong opinions about Kelly Wigglesworth coming back to the show? I know from following things like previously on Survivor, you were very excited about Jeff Varner coming back and T-Bird potentially coming back. Do you have any strong feelings about Kelly returning to the show after 15 years and what that means for the franchise?
You know, what's funny is that, you know, I'm the most diehard old school Survivor fan there is, to the point that people think I'm a jerk because I just am so fixated on the old seasons, I don't care about the new seasons. But Kelly Wigglesworth is the one character I've never had much of an attachment to. Like, I've used her in one of my stories once. I had no way to write her. There's almost nothing there you can grasp as a character to write Kelly. So I'm not particularly excited about her. And it's funny because she's the only person in Borneo I probably would say that about.
Yeah. It's weird to me. I feel like that she's a tough person to get a vibe from. I talked to her very briefly before they went away when we did the Second Chance interview. To me, you know, she seemed sort of just like lukewarm, excited about it. And I think that's going to be a very fun thing to watch as we get towards the fall and to see just how much she's into all of this stuff.
Yeah, you know what's funny is the very first time I was ever on your show was many years ago on the Fishbowl.
Yes.
And it was me, I was one of the guests, and Jenna Lewis was your co-host. And the other guest that day was Kelly Wigglesworth.
Yeah.
And all I remember is that Jenna never shut up. She talked the whole episode, and I could barely get a word in. But even then, I still spoke more than Kelly said. And she said nothing, like, for 2 hours.
Yeah, I used to see her a little bit, like, when I first moved to L.A., like, she used to be around like, 2004. But even then, she wasn't, like, pumped up about Survivor. Like, Jenna Lewis, you know, would still be into it, and that was, like, coming right off of All Stars. But Kelly never really seemed to love the show. She always seemed to be somewhat reluctant about it, and that's what's so crazy to me about her being back in the mix after all this time.
Well, yeah, I mean, you think Jervis coming back was like a shot in the dark come out of nowhere. Like, how's Kelly Wigglesworth all of a sudden become relevant again?
I don't know.
Yeah. And again, I have nothing against her. I just don't have it. There's nothing really to say about her that's good or bad. That's kind of the thing with Kelly.
Go back to Tina. You said that Tina used the first Survivor as a weapon against the people in the second Survivor. And I know that Tina is one of your all time favorites. So talk about that, because I don't think I know that story either.
Yeah, this is a fun one. This is something I remember at the time that, you know, what a lot of people don't know unless you watch Survivor at the time is that the first season, while it was popular, and, you know, you got 50 million viewers, people were not happy with the ending. And, you know, I tell people this, I tell modern Survivor fans, you know, Borneo was not well received. People didn't like Richard winning. They're like, what? But he's the only one that used strategy. And I'm like, yeah, but it was very different back then. Like, that was the perception of Borneo among I'm not going to say everyone, but probably 90% of the viewers at the time was that it was a fun little social experiment. It was cute. They had fun watching it. And then it got really nasty and evil at the end because all the cheaters won. And that's the one thing that cannot be emphasized enough about that first season. That was the perception, is that it started out good and then it went bad.
Yeah, the bad guy won.
The bad guy won. No, the bad guys won. I mean, Tagi, they used the alliance, those cheaters.
Yeah. And yeah, Rudy didn't win.
Rudy didn't win. Rudy is the one, which is funny when the homophobic old guy is your hero. Something odd has happened.
It was a different time.
It was a different time, yes. So then anyway, we come to the second season in Australia. And the one thing I love pointing out about Australia is that watch how many times that season the players mentioned, oh, we want the good guys to win this time. Well, this time it's going to be different. This time the deserving people will get to the end. And this is like the whole theme of Australia. And that's why I always say Australia is different than any other season, because it's so rooted in what happened before it determines what plays out in Australia. So right at the forefront of this movement, you'll notice if you watch Australia, is the person saying this over and over. This time we want the good guys to win. The good guys are going to win this time. I want the good Christian nice people to win this time around. And that's Tina. Tina's the one saying this the entire season.
Yeah.
And I love that because she is literally using the first season as a weapon for why she needs to get to the end. Because you will notice in Tina's strategy that she is definitely one of the good people. So if the good people need to get to the end, then I think I should get to the end because I'm a nurse and I'm Christian and I say prayers and I'm the mom. And this is something I love about Tina, because she has no interest in the good people getting to the end. If you pay attention to that season, she backstabs her best friend Mad Dog without a thought in the world. She backstabs her next best friend Mitchell right after that. Like, she has no interest in the good people getting to the end. She wants Tina to get to the end. And that's one thing I always love about Tina. And I have chapters about her in my book about how Tina won and why her win is so unique, because she legitimately uses the first season as a weapon for why she should win Survivor.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I never really heard it put that way. I know also from Australia, now we have Jeff Varner and Kimmy Kappenberg back in the mix. How much does that blow your mind that we're about to see Jeff and Kimmy come back into the fold here? I mean, I would have thought there was a 0% chance that was ever happening.
Well, yeah, this what's funny is that talking to you, I know this blows your mind as well, because these people were like celebrities to you. I mean, if you're on Survivor, you know all the players who came before you. Like, Kimmy and Varner were larger-than-life figures. Am I correct? From you to you, even?
Sure. Any Survivor was a larger-than-life figure to me.
Yeah. And so that's the thing. Like, Varner, I'm not particularly surprised came back, just because he's always been involved in the media. He does interviews. He's really media savvy. And he's just a good TV character.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kimmy, where they pulled her out of, I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah.
And again, I'm a huge Kimmy fan. I love every moment she's on the screen in Australia, even though she's only around for, what, 5 episodes?
Yeah.
I mean, she kills it every scene she's in. I could not be more happy to see Kimmy out there, because Kimmy is great, and she's not one that I think gets a lot of respect for what a big character she was.
Yeah, it really is wild. And I just think that maybe they say, okay, the first seasons were huge and they're just really mine. Like, I would have never thought they would have brought Jervis back, but there he is. And I think that they realize that there's some sort of capital in that these first couple seasons were watched by 40 million people. I don't know if anybody's tuning in to watch Kimmy that wasn't already watching Survivor 30, but for whatever reason, they feel like this is has some value, and I'm not mad at it. I'm fine with that.
It's different. It's different. That's the thing. That's not the way they approach returning season players returning player seasons.
You know, also on Survivor Second Chances, I know how much you were out there rooting for T-Bird to come back, and I certainly was. Have you talked to her at all after all this?
Yeah, this is a kind of a misconception. People always, you know, they think that my best friends in the Survivor world are like you, and everyone thinks I'm friends with Tina, even though I've never actually talked to Tina in my entire life. But T-Bird is like the one Survivor over the years that I've been friends with kind of on a personal level. I mean, she's pulled some strings for me in the past. We met up at some fan events. She got me tickets to a finale once. And just with my book, she cheerleaded me to get my book published when I was very discouraged about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. She's like, you have to keep you have to keep working at it. You know, I believe in you, Mario. You're going to get this book done. So I'm really good friends with T-Bird, and I've talked to her a lot in the last couple of weeks. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, betray her feelings on stuff, but she was absolutely crushed that she didn't get on this show. And
I know
that hurts. That really hurts me. She, like, again, she's the only Survivor I really, really stay in touch with. And so that one hurt to see how bad that hurt her.
You know, and I feel bad that I haven't reached out since all of this happened. I just don't know, you know, what to even say about all of this. But I know how excited she was to potentially do it. And I was surprised that she didn't, like, especially when Jeff and Kimmy both get in. Like, if it was all new people, I would get that. But then if they're putting Jeff and Kimmy back, it seems weird to me that T-Bird would miss the cut like that.
Yeah, it seems odd that she would not make it and Kimmy would, just because at no point in Survivor history would you consider Kimmy a bigger character than T-Bird, which is particularly funny because in my book, you know, if only if my book had come out like a couple months ago, I spend like the last 100 pages talking about how T-Bird is one of the most underrated survivors ever. So like maybe the timing could have been a little better for me to get my book out when maybe it could have swayed some votes or something. But it's just weird that, you know, like, people say, well, I can't believe Shane got snubbed. And I'm like, I can believe Shane got snubbed because he's very polarizing. Like, he was a big character, but he's also kind of a villain at times. Like, you can like him, you can hate him, but there's mixed opinions. I have never met somebody who dislikes T-Bird. So that's why it's even more baffling to me.
Yeah. Now, you talk in your book also about some of the personal interactions that you've had with the survivors. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. I try to, one of the things, I don't know, one of the TV shows I watch a lot is The Next Food Network Star, or just Food Network in general, when they interview these people. And one of the things that they always tell these people when they're interviewing for a job is, you know, don't just go out there and talk about food. You have to explain a personal story why the food is important to you. And that's something I really kind of took to heart when I was writing this book. Like, I'm not just explaining why Survivor is a big deal. I included lots of stories why it's a big deal to me, some interactions and why they were important to me, and some that I just find were goofy. So yeah, I have a lot of personal stories. There's one in there particular where I met Lindsay Richter for the first time, which is one of my all-time favorite Survivor stories.
Okay. Could you give us the short version?
Yeah, I will give you the short version. All right. So,
I mean, you could give us the long version. I don't want you to give the whole book away.
Yeah, I'll give you the short version. Basically, I was in an event at the Thailand finale. There was a brunch the day before the Thailand finale back in 2002. I think that was the year.
Mm-hmm.
And T-Bird is there. T-Bird is the host for the event. And she knows that I'm a big fan of a blonde survivor, which is Tina. I'm a huge Tina Wesson fan. And T-Bird knew that, but she somehow got the wrong survivor name. She thought I was a huge fan of Lindsay. And so she walks over and she introduces me to Lindsay, because Lindsay Richter, you know, Lindsay was a huge villain at the time. People hate her. She would be so excited to have a fan. So basically I went over and I had a really long conversation with Lindsay under the guise that I was like the biggest Lindsay Richter fan on the face of the earth.
Yeah.
Which was not true, because I couldn't stand Lindsay like most people in America.
Right. It wouldn't take much to be the biggest Lindsay fan in the world. If you just mildly liked her, you'd be the biggest fan.
Yeah. And that's the gist of the story. Lindsay was so excited because she actually had a fan. She had never had a fan before.
Okay.
And so I felt horrible. I mean, not horrible enough not to write it about it in my book. But so I had to sit there for 20 minutes and we're having this conversation and she's so excited because she has her fan. And that's what we talked about this. And meanwhile, I have to tell T-Bird later, I was actually not a Lindsay fan. I was a Tina fan. So that's one of my stories.
Have you had any negative experiences with the survivors in person?
Let's see. In person, no. In person, it's generally very, how would I say this? Just a clinical meeting. You just say, hi, how are you? Oh, I know this about the show. So in person, I tend to not have very emotional interactions with people. Although I do have a picture I got. I have a picture of me with Russell Hance.
Yes.
Our arms are under each other, which is a fun one because he had no idea who I was.
Yeah, but did you write about that at all? Your interactions with Russell Hance?
Not in this book. This book only goes through the first three seasons.
Okay.
So it's really meant to be kind of a start of a series. I want to do a bunch of series of Survivor books. But yeah, this one, I specifically went through the first three seasons, although there is an interesting story in there where I met Rudy Bosch on the Santa Monica Pier.
Yes.
That was a fun one. He was the first survivor I ever met.
And how was that going when you met Rudy?
It was good because I told him I also had a problem with queers. No, I'm just kidding. I didn't say that. It was very awkward because Rudy is an awkward person. What do you say to Rudy if you meet him in person?
I think that, well, Rudy, he's almost like a doll that you like pull the string in the back. He only says like a certain amount of things. So you have to like sort of like frame your questions to get one of those responses.
Yeah. So Rudy, did you get that machete sharp?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sharp. No. Why does
he
need it so sharp?
One of your favorites.
Yeah. Anytime anybody has a sharp machete, I love that. And so what was Rudy doing on the Santa Monica Pier?
He was just walking around with his wife, Marge.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where my wife and I talked to Rudy for a couple minutes. Oh, hey, we're big fans, blah, blah, blah. And then he left and my wife's like, you know, that was rude. We didn't even say hi to his wife.
Yeah.
So it's just little stuff like that. When you meet a lot of survivors, you have to learn, remember, they have spouses too. You should probably be nice to their spouses.
Yes. Yes, you should. All right. So just to go back to the Russell Hance thing real quick, because I said, just in case that I feel like there's probably people that are listening to this who don't know everything from your backstory. You got into a big feud with Russell. Was it during Samoa or was it during Heroes versus Villains?
It was during Heroes versus Villains.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I'll give this story. This is a fun one. I haven't talked about this in a while. I was basically retired from being a Survivor writer. I wasn't doing anything for about 4 or 5 years there. And people would always ask me, hey, what do you think of this new guy, Russell? And I'm like, well, he's interesting, but he's not going to win. I always called him, phrases I use for players like Russell, he's a 38-day player. He does really well.
Hey.
Yeah, win.
Hey.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You could have won. Rob, you and
us
Russell.
38-day players are sensitive.
You girls, you're both pretty, Rob.
Yeah. Well, Russell's a 39-day player, in fairness to Russell.
I'm not sure. I'm not entirely sure he's a 39-day player.
Well, he does make it 39 days.
Yeah, and then he threatens to put Natalie on the jury when they're in the final two.
He was very drunk, in fairness to Russell.
Yeah, so I'm out of retirement, and Russell's around, and I'd written this chapter a while back. It was on my website called The Psychology of a Survivor Jury, basically how, you know, a-holes can never win jury votes in Survivor.
Yeah.
What happened is people started posting this chapter to Russell's Facebook page. And I had nothing to do with it, but people kept posting it. Hey, this guy says you suck at Survivor, Russell. I'm like, I didn't say anything about Russell. And all of a sudden, now he starts this crusade where he tells people to go run me off the internet. He tells his legion of fans to come and drive me off the internet and tell this guy he's a full of crap.
He's going to put you on the jury.
Yeah, exactly. But I had nothing to do with it. So all of a sudden, now there's this big fight. And then Stephen Fishbach got dragged into it for a while. He had some post about who are the best players never to win, I think. And someone had mentioned Steven and someone mentioned Russell. And then, of course, someone posted my jury chapter to rebut the Russell thing. And now the whole thing starts up again. And now it's basically me against like 500,000 Russell fans on every message board on the internet. And again, I was like Chris Doherty. I was just laying there in the hammock. I wasn't doing anything.
Yeah.
So Russell and I had this big blowout and it got kind of personal. And that was really the only reason I decided to write the funny 115 version too, because I wanted to just shit on Russell for 300 pages.
Wait, so. Is there a lot about Russell in the second funny 115?
Oh, yes. There's two entire entries that are detailed the fall of Russell, where I just point out how horrible he is at everything and crap on him. Just
yeah.
Because it's the one forum I knew I could do that, where people wouldn't just rebut me and slam me with posts over and over trying to drown me out.
Now, see, I didn't realize that the book was just the first three seasons. So you have like 70 essays about stuff from the first three seasons?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, this is not like a little quickie book that someone just threw together. This is me writing for 3 or 4 years, everything I could think of about Survivor. And basically, I came to a publisher kind of work with me for a while. And he's like, you know, if you're planning to write about 30 seasons, this is going to be, you know, a 2,500-page book. So how about we just write about the first three seasons, we can whittle it down to about 200 pages, and it's marketable, because that was their thing. We can't sell a book that's real big, like it's a niche market.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up being 470 pages about three seasons, and there's 70 essays. I have a whole chapter in there called The Underrated. People, I think, were underrated, and they should be written about more. I have a thing in there. This is my diplomatic chapter I called The Real Survivor Hall of Fame, because I think the one that everyone talks about now is a joke. So I'm like, here's if we really did a Survivor Hall of Fame, who should be in it. So there's lots of stuff in here, but again, it's only three seasons because I was trying to keep the book short into a marketable level.
So what criteria do you use to come up with the Hall of Fame? Is it like the Baseball Hall of Fame, where it's like based on like the best players, or is it the most iconic players? Like, for instance, like a player like a Jerry. Mm-hmm. And are you looking at them just in their first season, or is it in the entire, you know, career of that person?
Yeah, I don't care about returning player seasons. Like, that doesn't really come into a factor. What I'm mostly looking at is how important they were to the Survivor franchise. Like, when there's a history book written about Survivor one day, which essentially I tried to do, this is a Survivor history book, which people do you remember should be remembered as being significant to Survivor? So whether they were a good player or a bad player, whether they're a hero or a villain, is really not relevant to me as so much as how big was this person to that season. So Jerry is an absolute slam dunk first ballot. I mean, that's when you talk about Survivor of the early days, Jerry has to be right up there with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I looked at it. It's significance as a character.
Okay. And so how many people from the first three seasons did you include in that list?
For the first season, okay, I made an argument in the book that you could really take all 16 players from Borneo because it really was that important in the season. And I really think you need to start with the solid foundation of the originals. But in the interest of actually keeping it somewhat selective, I only took 8 of the 16 players from Borneo. And then with Australia, I took 7 because my argument is you shouldn't have as many from the second season as the first because Borneo should always be the most important. So I took 7 Australians. Yeah, I did 6 Africans. So just basically, I'm going to whittle it down. It'll be smaller and smaller numbers to the point that I think maybe 2 or 3 max will make it from later seasons, if that. But I think those early seasons have to be highly represented in that book. Like I made an argument that Dr. Sean, well, admittedly not the best player in Survivor history, like Borneo, the entire second half of that show revolves around his alphabet strategy. And that was very significant to how it played out. So I think he's a very important figure in Survivor history because of that.
Do you feel like the casting for the first couple seasons, like it would have worked with anybody they would have put out there, or they just did such a great job, or they got lucky, or however you want to do it? Like, was there some magic to the people that were cast in the first couple seasons?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to think here. I think they went out there and they interviewed people with charisma.
Yeah.
That's why all I think they really cared about, like, because they weren't, we don't want the strategists. We don't need people that are super smart. We want to get 16 people from different walks of life, and they all have to have charisma. They have to be interesting when you watch them. You want to see what they say in an interview. So I think they did a really good job of casting for what that show was supposed to be.
Yeah. Because I know that you are part of the Survivor Historians podcast, which I'm sure we'll touch on as we go along here. And you've done the rewatch, and I've also done a Survivor rewatch, and I hadn't watched any Survivor. Unlike you, like I experienced it when it was on, and I haven't gone back and looked at any of it. But there were so many times, like in those first couple seasons, that I really did feel like there were, you know, magical, beautiful moments of some of these people and the interactions that we have with these characters.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And I would say that's mostly because the first season in particular is different than every other season because it's really more of a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. If you know the history of Mark Burnett, he had the show Eco Challenge before Survivor. And so Survivor is really just Eco Challenge. It's just they took real footage and they tried to shape it into a narrative somehow. It's like in my book, I compare it to the Blair Witch Project, which is something that Mark Burnett has said in interviews before, too, that Blair Witch Project completely influenced Survivor. It's the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So it's a documentary, but it's also very like the cinematography of the first season and the first couple seasons is very different because it's almost like they're making a movie.
Yeah.
It's just the sound cues are really beautiful. The music is really well done. It's not just a strategy game. It's like they're making a movie. And that's something that's different in the first season. And I hear people say the first season's boring compared to later seasons. And I can see why you would say that. But my argument is, well, it's just a different product. They're not trying to make a strategy game. They're making a movie out of found footage, just like the Blair Witch Project.
And for the most part, I don't find the first season to be boring. You know, when I went back and watched it, and again, maybe it's the nostalgia that's part of it, but I think that there is quite a bit there. And also, like, the game, I do feel like, there, you know, Richard almost gets voted out. Like, there's a couple times where the thing almost goes back in the other direction, and there is suspense over the whole Kelly thing. Is she defecting or is she not? I mean, for a season that gets a bad rap, I think, for being boring, I don't think it's that boring, the gameplay of the first season.
Yeah, it's the thing, though. You're not watching it for the game. You're watching it for the characters. You're just watching to see what's going to happen next. That's the only way I can describe Borneo. And it's kind of interesting. Since I wrote my book, I have a bunch of coworkers. I work in a computer office. We're all just programmers. A lot of people I work with have no idea what Survivor is. They've never seen it. So they're curious what this TV show I wrote a book about is. And I've been explaining it to people and I gave them my book and stuff. And what's funny is one of my coworkers, a guy named Troy, he'd never seen Survivor. He had no clue what it was. But he heard I wrote a book about it. So he said, hey, can you give me the first season on DVD? Can I watch it? And then I'll read your book. And so I gave it to him. He has no idea what Survivor is. He's been watching it this week. And every day he comes in, he's like, I love this show. This is the greatest show I've ever seen. It's so cool. It's so heartening for me to see that and see people relive the experience that I had and you had way back in 2000. It's just really neat to see that.
Yeah. Now, One of the things I really liked about when you started doing the Survivor Historians, it's this idea of that there are people who are fans of the show now who are too young to remember what the first season of Survivor was like, or what Survivor was like for the beginning. What do you tell people who ask you about what Survivor was like when it first started?
Yeah, it's the one thing I say, and this is exactly how I start my book out too, that when they build this show, no one really knew what it was about. The way they build it on TV was 16 people are going to be on an island and the last person standing wins. I mean, it was really like someone's going to die out there. That's the way they build the show when it first came out. And there had never been anything like this on TV before. And I know people are going to say, well, it was on in Europe, but Americans, we don't care what's going on in Europe. As far as we know, the Survivor started in 2000 with the American version.
They still have Utopia in Europe.
Will Utopia thrive? How's Bella doing? Is Bella the survivalist still on there?
Yes. Jake and the bees are all doing great in Europe.
Are they the Africanized bees? Are they more aggressive? Or are they the European bees?
That's where they went when the bees were on another job. They were on the European Utopia.
Oh, I miss Utopia.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, that's what I tell people, that, you know, Survivor was billed as this, they're going to throw 16 people on an island and 15 are going to die and one's going to be left, or who's people are going to quit because they can't take it. So it was just a horrible show. It's like, why would anybody watch that? And so people would tune in that first night and you'd see all this stuff about people being voted out and strategy. And it's like, well, that wasn't the show that they built. That's a whole different thing. And so I think what happened was people kind of got wrapped up in this. All of a sudden it's a new game they weren't expecting. And said, and the one thing in my book I talk about a lot is psychology, how Survivor is basically just evil psychology. Mm-hmm. And that's my whole background is in schools. I studied psychology, criminal psychology, sociology, all that stuff. And that's all that Survivor is, where you force people to band together to form a little society. And then all of a sudden, halfway through, you make them turn on each other. Like, by the way, all your allies, you are now arch enemies. You're going to turn on each other. And it's just, it's a horrible thing to do. Like, if that was a psychology experiment in a college, they would make you do debriefing afterwards. They would have ethics advisors in there asking if this was okay to do this to people. It's just, it's a horrible game. And so I think that's how I explain to people. It's just this really nasty psychology game that was billed as people living on an island, and the audience wasn't ready for it. It was much nastier than people really realized at first.
Have you ever given any thought about the longevity of Survivor and what is it about it that has been so appealing for so long?
Well, the first couple seasons, I would say a lot of it was just travel porn. They're going somewhere exciting. Oh, look, they're in Africa now. Oh, they're in the Australian outback. So there's a lot of that. Oh, where are they going to go this time? But then, like, the first season was so engrossing, just the storytelling and the music and the editing, the way they threw it all together, that it was just such a well-done TV product that really helped those first couple seasons for people who might not have liked reality TV. They were intrigued by this because it was just a different product altogether. So that kept the show going for a while. And then you kind of get attached to the players. You get the fan base starts to develop, the internet fan base, which I've always been a part of. And then you kind of got All-Stars, and All-Stars is a whole different thing. And then after that, the game kind of changes. We're returning players and different strategy, and they manipulate it into more of a strategy game. So the longevity of Survivor has really been because it's been able to adapt and change to different audiences.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't personally like the modern product very much, but I can see why it appeals to people, and I can see that's a big part of why Survivor has lasted, because you think of these TV shows that are on forever, they lose their viewers. Like, TV shows don't have 20 million viewers forever. They slowly go down and down and down. Survivor has been the oddest show because it's been able to pick up new viewers along the way. Like, what show picks up a new viewers in its 28th season? It's the weirdest thing. There's no comparison to Survivor. That's why it warrants books. There should be lots of history books and TV books written about this show because it's unique.
How long do you think Survivor can go for?
I thought it was going to die years ago. I thought it was done around 13 and 14, right around there.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, it could go forever. It's really, I've heard people say it goes until Jeff Probst says that's enough.
Yeah. No, I agree with that.
What do you think? I'm curious what you think about that.
I agree with that. You know, I don't remember what I was reading. I want to say it was something, maybe it was an article from Dalton Ross that was written around the 15th anniversary of Survivor. And there was some talk about how Jeff Probst wanted to walk away after around Panama. That was around the time that Jeff was contemplating leaving. And then it seemed like there was another point in time where survivors seemed especially vulnerable, like following the Survivor One World era around 24, where it was like, okay, Jeff Probst is going to leave and go host the Jeff Probst talk show, and Survivor is going to potentially get a new host, and that was probably going to be the end. How long could it go on with a new host? But right now is sort of a weird era of Survivor where it's just like, it could potentially just like, who knows where it's going to go? Because I feel like the history of the show is always that, well, they're going to go like two more seasons and then it's going to end. But right now it's sort of like in a weird spot where it's just like we don't know what's in front of us right now.
Yeah, it's weird. They've got the social media thing figured out. They got Twitter figured out. They have fans voting. Like, they're very good at drawing in the fans to feel like they're part of the show now, you know, with all the Ponderosa videos. And of course, I mean, you're not affiliated with the show, but Rob Has a Podcast is now kind of a fan experience. It's part of the show, really, for people. So it has all worked out. They've become very interactive, and it's really worked out for them.
Yeah, it's been a weird thing. And, you know, I don't want to make it only, you know, Rob has a podcast. I think that the Survivor internet community has really, you know, mounted an interesting thing, because I think that one of the fun things about, you know, but whether it's podcasts or Facebook group and Reddit and all these different things, that there's a fun thing about Survivor and Big Brother, that there's a little bit of like a Tony and Tina's Wedding element to all of it when you go online. Because let's say that you're, you know, you're a Game of Thrones fan. Well, you know, Jon Snow isn't really going to talk to you on the internet. Whereas stuff like this, or you're a baseball fan and your favorite baseball player isn't going to, Robinson Cano isn't going to be talking to you on Facebook, Mario.
I've been trying for years. It's not going to happen.
But a show like Survivor, a show like Big Brother, you know, these people, not only are they going to want to talk to you, that, you know, you end up finding the right ones, they're going to be calling you on the phone. You're going to be like, hey, I got to go to work. Like, you know, hey, we got to scale back this friendship.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. That's one of my criticisms of current Survivor, and it drives me crazy. That seems like the fans are way too close to the players nowadays. Like, when the stuff like Shireen and Will happens, people take that so personally because they feel like these are their friends.
Yeah.
And again, that drives me crazy because I feel it's unhealthy. Like, I don't think that's a good relationship. But at the same time, that's totally why Survivor still thrives, because the fans are so immersed in it.
Yeah. You know, the climate right now with the Survivor stuff, and I know that the Shireen and Will thing was so ugly, I feel like there's a couple of incidents from the past of Survivor that, had they happened, I'm not even sure if Survivor would have been able to survive, you know, something like a Ted and Gandia today.
Oh, the Ted and Gandia one, the Richard and Sue and All Stars. I mean, there is some really nasty stuff in those early seasons. What do you have, Rob Zabaknik and Shian? There was some nasty stuff in Thailand even.
Yeah.
There was some really nasty interactions, and you just didn't have the immediacy and really the outrage back then, because people couldn't react as quickly. I mean, but again, although let's not gloss over these early seasons. I mean, Jeri Manthe probably got 10,000 death threats in 2001.
So, and she didn't even do anything.
I know. And I write about that in my book a lot. I defend her. I have a whole chapter called In Defense of Jeri, and basically how she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. The franchise needed a villain. They needed something nasty to happen, and she just happened to be right there, and she got nailed by it. But yeah, that's the thing. She did nothing, but she got death threats. People were talking about how she was horrible. She got a worse Survivor experience than anyone. So it's not like the fans were so benign back then either.
Well, one of the things I've heard you say in the past is that with the case of Jeri Manthe, that she walked away from Survivor Australia thinking she was the hero.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, because you can see that when you watch Australia. She thinks she's the hero. She thinks she and Colby are the center of that tribe, and halfway through the season, Colby backstabs her, and he becomes the villain.
Yeah.
And that's how she totally sees that season. She had no idea that any of that other storyline was there, of her being the villain, of, like, Tina being the hero, of Colby being the hero. It must have been horrifying for her to watch that show. And again, this is something I talk again in my book about, how Survivor isn't just one storyline. There's 16 storylines, and the editors and the producers just pick the one that makes the best story. So Jeri's story that she was the hero is probably perfectly correct, just like Colby and Tina's story that they were the heroes and Jeri was horrible is also perfectly correct, just depending on whose side, point of view you look at it from.
Can you talk a little bit about the journey to get to writing this book? Because you've written all of this stuff. Was it just that the technology was there now at this point in time that was why you decided to write the book?
I'm going to drop a much more serious answer on you than you're expecting.
Great.
I'm going to blow your mind here. So you get some ratings right here. Okay. So I'm a programmer in real life. I do computer programming. I get paid pretty well for it. But I have no affinity toward it. It's not a job that I love. It's just one of those. I always describe it as you're like a prostitute. You get paid, you lay back, you take it, you get paid, and that's it. I have no emotional connection to my job whatsoever. But I had this side career as an internet writer where I just would write stuff about Survivor or pop culture. And it was a fun side hobby, but I never made any money off of it. I wasn't expecting it to ever go anywhere. It's just something I did when I was bored. So a couple years ago, I had a coworker, a guy who was older than me named Cliff. I'm 40, he was about 60. He's 20 years older than me. And what happened is he killed himself, actually.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was one of these things. He was depressed with his life. He'd been a programmer for 40 years. There was nothing giving him joy in life. And it was a horrible thing at our office. He was a friend of mine. And what happened is they brought in a grief counselor to talk to all of us. And what happened is something bad happens at a job. They bring in a grief counselor. So I'm like, you know, I'll go talk to this lady. And I talked to her for a while. And I said, you know, I'm in a job that I don't care about. I'm going to be in this job my entire life. I have no emotional connection to this whatsoever. And that's exactly what someone like Cliff has. Like, is that going to be me in 20 years? Like, not that I'm depressed or anything, but is that all you have to look forward to is being stuck in a job until you die? Is there anything bigger in life?
Mm-hmm.
And what was funny, it was just kind of an interesting coincidence because this lady, her name is Dr. Deborah Holland. She is a self-published author. She'd done a lot of books. She'd published, she has like 6 or 7 books out there. And so we started talking. She's like, well, do you have any other hobbies? And I'm like, well, I have this writing thing, this Survivor writing. And she's like, have you ever tried to do a book? I'm like, no, I never really wanted to make anything monetary out of it because it seems silly. Like, who's going to read a book about Survivor? And she's like, well, do you have a large readership? And I'm like, well, I probably had about 500,000 readers at my peak. And she just kind of looks at me. She's like, seriously? She's like, you know what? How much I would kill for an audience of more than like 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, you have an audience, a readership of this many people, and you've never tried to exploit it and like make anything out of it. And I'm like, no. So basically, me just talking to the self-help counselor gave me this huge idea. She's like, you know how easy it is to self-publish books nowadays? You can do an ebook, you can do all this stuff. There's all this technology out there that has never existed. And I had no idea. I'd never looked into it before. I was just an internet writer.
Yeah,
and so I credit this lady, her name is Dr. Holland, for giving me this thing. Like I went into that meeting with her being all bummed, and I came out like with a new lease on life. I was so excited. I'd never been more excited in my life. Like I could actually do something with this, and I had no idea that was an option. So I was working on this essay on my website. It was called My Experiences with Survivor, and I'm like, that would be a fantastic book. So I just took it off the internet, and I just started adding to it, and I'm like, this is going to be a book someday, and I don't care if it only sells 50 copies. Like I could actually say, I took that leap because that's the thing. So many people don't make the leap to do something kind of scary in their lives.
Yeah.
So I actually did. I'm like, I'm going to do this. So I started writing it. And basically what happened was a publisher heard that I was publishing this book. I forget their name. They were an ebook publisher. And they're like, hey, we'd love to publish your book for you. You would be great if you could work with an editor and a publisher because you'll probably need that. I'm like, oh, that'd be great. I would love someone could help me out. And this is about 3 years ago. And so I start working with this publisher and they, you know, I worked on my book. They said, can you have it done by this day? We'll get it published. We'll do all the work. And so I finished the book and they just stopped returning my emails. And I'm like, what the hell is that?
Mm-hmm.
And like, I had this book that was done and I put all this work into it. Now I had no publisher, no editor. And I've been promising people, oh, I have a book coming out. And all of a sudden it fell through. I'm like, well, that sucks. So I started looking into self-publishing it again. And then another publisher came to me. You're going to see a pattern here. Hey, give us your book. I know it's going to be, we heard it's going to be a real fun, a history of Survivor book. You know, you have a big readership and we'll publish it for you. So I start working with them and another year is wasted where they basically fall through, their whole business falls apart and I never get my book published. So there's been a long trail of disappointment and frustration in me just trying to get this book out. Like I had all this goodwill back from Dr. Holland telling me you can do this and then it just didn't happen. So finally, someone hooked me up with Amazon. Amazon has a program now called CreateSpace where you can publish your own book. You send it in and basically you have complete editorial control over it. You have to edit it. You have to do the artwork, but you control everything about it. Amazon doesn't even take a cut. I mean, doesn't even charge you anything up front. They just, all the books you sell, they take a cut. You get your royalty and that's it. You have full editorial control over this book. And that's what ended up happening. But it was a long 3-4 year journey where I gave up a couple times, where I'm like, this sucks. I might as well just go back to the safe money of being a programmer. But again, people like T-Bird was really helpful and influential at the time. She's like, you know, you have to get this done. Like, this is your dream. You really need to finish it. I've read part of it. It's really good. So that's the thing. It's easy to publish books nowadays. And a lot of people don't realize that technology is out there, that you can do that.
So a lot of interesting things from there. I think that what you're talking about, this idea of, you know, hey, I want to, you know, do something that I love. I think that that's part at its core of the reason why Survivor is popular. I think for a lot of people, they look at, okay, well, I'm going to go on Survivor and that's going to be my thing. You know, that's going to be the thing that's going to help me get through the day of that. You know, that could be me out there. That could be my moment in the sun.
Yeah, and I've heard that before. I know I happen to be friends with Kathy Sleckman from Micronesia, from Fan Versus Favorites, and sure. She said that. She said, I was going through a divorce at the time. I was just kind of bummed. I'm like, why not? Just go on Survivor, see what happens. So it is. It's kind of a something new that maybe something might be missing from your life. I mean, there's the weird people that are just total adventure junkies. They just want to do adventure. But I do think for a lot of people, they're not maybe not happy with what's going on in their life. They want something a little different, and Survivor has been giving them an outlet for them to do something different and see what happens. And again, I'm not a player. I've never been affiliated with the show, but in my case, that's definitely true. I'm like, I just want to do something that I can say I tried in my life. I tried something that was a dream of mine, and I want to see if I can make it as a writer. So, I mean, maybe there's some inspiration. Maybe there's some young person out there can hear that and be inspired by that. But and that's the lesson that I got from it. Like, if you're not happy with what you're doing, try something new. It might be scary, but at least you can say you did it.
Now, the foreword for your book by Rob Cesternino, that did not entice all sorts of publishers to jump in?
It did. It was, again, I got two publishers, and at least one of those might have been just because you were involved. So I appreciate you hooking me up with these horrible publishers.
And it might have also been the reason why they left also.
Yes. Yeah,
we thought it was Boston Rob.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Right.
But yeah, no, Rob wrote me a very nice foreword. And what's funny is you wrote that like 4 years ago, so you probably have no idea what you wrote anymore.
I honestly couldn't remember what I wrote, but I'm sure it was from the heart.
It's all references to Lost and how Heroes is the greatest TV show ever and stuff.
It wasn't that long ago. But I was, you know, right after I had done my season, or right around the time my season started to air, that was when I started to become familiar with what you were doing. And, you know, there wasn't really too many other people that I was like really pumped up to get to talk to around that time.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. When Rob and I met for the first time, we were both big fans of one another. So it was like this geek off. It was kind of funny. But
yeah.
That was the thing. That's one thing I try to stress in my book. I'm not really a person who likes to brag. I'm pretty humble. I come from a very humble background, but like, I was literally the only person on the internet at the time writing about strategy mm-hmm. or psychology and that, like, pop culture, psychology, how Survivor relates to all this. All the other writing back in the early days was just about, here's a spoiler, here's what's going to happen, here's an interview with a player. It's just stuff like that. Oh, here's an interview with them after they got voted. I was the only person that was kind of delving into Survivor on a deeper level. And that's, again, I'm like the brightest guy in the world. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time because that's what the audience kind of wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was doing this thing called the Survivor Power Rankings. Who's in the best spot to win Survivor this week? And no one was doing anything like that on the internet at the time. So it's just, I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And to the point now that every Survivor website does these power rankings, but that was not how people wrote about the show back in the day.
Yeah. What's been the biggest change that you've seen throughout the history of Survivor in as far as how Survivor is covered?
The way I describe it is that it's very slick now. It's just a well-oiled machine. Like, everything runs very smoothly. It's just, there aren't as many surprises as I think you would have seen back in the day. Like, Mike falling in the fire. That just kind of came out of nowhere. Like, mm-hmm. It was a very raw product, and they didn't really have all the contingencies down. So a lot of the times, you were seeing their mistakes. It was kind of a very clumsy, clunky product the first couple seasons, which I think I find endearing. I think it was very cute to see them try to figure it out as it went along. It's not as cute anymore. It's very slick. That's the way I describe it. But the one thing I will say is the show is much sneakier with how they work in the humor now and the little funny stuff. Like, people have heard me say that I don't think the show is as funny anymore. That's not necessarily true. There's just a lot of subtle funny stuff. The editors are constantly throwing little sneaky stuff in there that they didn't used to do. So the last three or four seasons in particular, I think they've gotten really good at these little hidden jokes that I'm dying to write about on the new Funny 115 one day.
That's all very interesting as far as how the show goes. What I meant to ask is, as far as like from the meta perspective of this way that we're covering the show on the internet, the people that are out there talking, blogging, podcasting, yeah. What have you seen in terms of how that's evolved over 15 years?
Well, the thing is that every Survivor fan on the internet, okay, most of the Survivor fans on the internet, know exactly how the game is played. Like, they're all strategy experts now.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. You just have a lot of fans out there who have seen 30 seasons. You know full well how to play Survivor after watching 30 seasons of it. So it's very based on strategy now. Oh, which player should do this? Maybe they should have done that. That's the thing. It's the audience is just smarter now. And so that's the way I look at it, that I tend to find it kind of insufferable sometimes when the audience gets a little too smart for its own good.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, the audience was not particularly bright sometimes back in the early days too. So it's kind of a mix. I would like it to be somewhere in the middle, but I would definitely see the audience is smarter now. They understand the game much better, which is very ironic considering that Russell brought in a lot of fans and he doesn't understand the game at all. But in general, I think this fan base is very smart now. And you have all the podcasts based on strategy, which players should do what, and all stuff like that. And then there's also the meta game of so many people on the show trying to play to become returning players, trying to become characters that'll be brought back.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of meta stuff in there as well. But from a fan perspective, just there's way more strategy talk now than there ever was before. It's really not about characters anymore. It's about players.
You know, but I do think that one of the fun things that we get to do here with the way that Survivor is in 2015, you know, in Survivor 2, Survivor 3, you'd have a person who was a great character on the show, then they'd get voted out, and then that was really it. You would never see or hear from them ever again, you know, unless you went to some sort of a reality event or something like that. But the great thing, again, just going back to this idea of sort of like this Tony and Tina's wedding, and I'm probably, most people listening don't even know what I'm talking about, but the idea that you could have somebody who's a great character on the show, and then through social media and also that, like, that character is able to continue to live on off of the show.
Yeah. And I would play devil's advocate and say, I don't think that's a good thing. I mean, I think it's fantastic that people get to see their favorite characters over and over, but with a sense of finality, like that was it and their time is over. It drives home how horrible and sad it is that someone gets voted off of Survivor.
Interesting.
Yeah. And this is something that I really tried to drive home in my stories, in my All-Star stories, that when a player was voted out, I treated it like they died almost in my story. Like it was sad. Their dream was just crushed and they're done. You'll never hear from them again. So I really try to drive that home, how horrible it is that people get voted out in my stories. And again, that's not really the case anymore. So while I think it's nice that you get the gratification of seeing your favorite players back again, I do think it meant more when they only had one chance.
Okay. Talk to me about Survivor 31. Are you excited that they did this second chance season? Because yes, you get to have some of these players back, but I know you are not fond of the returning player seasons.
I'm just not. And that's something I've always talked about. I've never wavered from that. I just don't feel that returning player seasons is really Survivor anymore. It's really just popularity and who can hustle their way into the most like friendships before the season starts. So I'm not thrilled of any returning player season, and that goes for all of them. It's not specifically this one, but I am thrilled at some of the characters that are back just because they're different, like Jeff Varner, Kimmy. I'm a huge Andrew Savage fan, and I know that's controversial.
Oh, I didn't know that. He's not.
I love Zion, and I've often said, people say, who do you think deserved the second chance the most? I'm like, Andrew Savage got screwed harder than anybody in the history of Survivor, a twist that nobody could have seen coming, with the exception of maybe Silas in Africa. He couldn't have seen that coming either. So Savage, I'm really excited to see play again, even though I don't think he'll do that well, but I just think it's good for him. But I love some of the players that came back. So while I'm not fond of returning player seasons, I am interested to see how it's going to play out with such a mix of people from different eras.
Have you given any thought as to who could potentially win that season? I know you've done with your All-Star, you know, Alaska and Hawaii, where you've simulated an entire season. Have you given any thought to how this is going to play out, or it's not that interesting to you?
No, it is interesting to me. This is something I've said before, that, you know, I role played those seasons really. That wasn't just a story. That was me role playing Survivor, trying to figure out how an All-Stars would play out. And in all the years I did those stories, I could not write a story. I could not role play a story where a male won. it's always a female. Females always win those returning player All-Star seasons. And that was when Amber won that first All-Stars. That's why I wasn't surprised at all. I'm like, well, it's going to be Amber or Jenna Lewis because they're the two that least deserve to be there. And then it happened again with, you know, Mike Renesia. Parvati was one of the least likely players to be there. And then, again, Sandra comes back. But it's one of these things. A female is almost guaranteed to win the season. Males, I don't think, can win these type of seasons because they all target one another. So if you were to go on past history based on everything I've ever seen and learned about the show, pick one of the females who nobody's going to be scared of at the start. And I'm looking at someone like Kelly Wentworth right there. And it'll probably be someone like that, maybe Tasha. Some of these people that the other players might not know that well, and they're not going to be a threat, and they're just never going to be in danger. So I would suspect this will play out much like every other one.
Okay, we'll see. What about Cochran and Tyson? I think that Cochran, you could certainly make the case that, you know, while, you know, it was not a woman in Cochran, he did come into the game with some baggage where I don't think anybody thought he could actually win based on the first game that he played.
Yeah, I could make two comments to that. That was a fans versus favorites season, right? Or was that a full All-Stars?
That was fans versus favorites.
Yeah, and those are a little different dynamic because it's really an eight-player season because the fans have no chance whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little different dynamic, but I could also make the cheap shot joke that Cochran was the most like a woman out of any of the players there, so he was not very threatening.
And what about Tyson? Was it because of the hole that he hurt his shoulder?
It could be, but again, that was a blood versus water, so half the players there weren't returning players.
Yeah.
So it's the dynamic's a little different in those fans versus favorites. I really hesitate to lump those in with the All-Star seasons where it's all returning players.
Yeah.
But Tyson did a great job. I mean, he toned it down. He was a good leader. He had a great game. I have nothing bad to say about him. I think it's a different dynamic.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the Survivor Historians and where you guys are now. You are just into Survivor Panama.
Yes.
Now, is there a point for you? I know you have such reverence for the older seasons, but as you go along on Survivor Historians, is there a point where now you're up to seasons that you don't care for as much?
Yeah, we're definitely in the middle seasons that I'm not as big a fan of.
Yes.
And what happened is when I discuss the show, I'm very reverential about the history, what was important and stuff like that. Once we get to these middle seasons, I still try to do that, but it really just becomes us cracking jokes about the season. It's more, basically, it's the evolution of the funny 115 you can see right there. It's the less I really started to care about the season, the more cutting and the more notable the jokes got.
Yeah. So what's your favorite thing that you've seen about Survivor Panama so far and going back and watching that?
Well, we just did part two of our Panama podcast, which was the Bruce's pooping episode.
Yes.
It's hard to top the unintentional hilarity in the Bruce being medevac scene.
Yeah, because Shane Powers like doesn't even have pants on.
Yeah, Courtney's trying to sing to him. He's like, please don't sing. And then she starts singing. And then there's one part he's writhing in pain and she pokes her head. She's like, are you getting better? He's like, no.
No. Yeah.
It's just one of those, like when Mike Scoopin was a medevac, everyone was at camp. They're all reverential. Elizabeth was there. Varner, they had some great speeches. In the Bruce one, you have the two worst possible people to be stuck at camp narrating this thing.
Yeah.
And one has no pants.
Yeah, it is a very wacky season, Panama, because you have all those interesting characters that are there with Aris, who somehow is like the normal one in that group. And yeah. Then you have all these, you know, between Shane and Danielle and Courtney and Bruce. It is a very funny season.
If there's one thing I can recommend about our show is that in this last episode, do you remember when Bruce is medevac? Do you remember the sad music they play?
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know the name of the title. I always called it the Jenna's Dying Mom music. It's the one they played when Jenna's mom died in All-Stars.
Okay.
It's like two of the only times they've ever played it.
Yeah.
Well, at the end of our Historians podcast, we always do a little stinger, which is like a little joke quote from the show or something. We decided to play that sad Bruce music. Except I had our editor insert little fart noises into it every so often, like Bruce is trying to squeeze one out.
Yeah.
If you listen to it, it's impossible to listen to that song and not laugh. I was dying when I heard what our editor did with it.
Poor Bruce.
And that's the thing. I had a son who went through something very similar to what Bruce went through. My son, when he was 5-6 years old, he was constipated. And we had to rush him to the emergency room, and it's the scariest thing in the world. And I say this to someone with a parent. Someday you may run into that. It's very scary. But so I have a lot of reverence for what Bruce went through, and it's horrible, but man, that scene is not expected to be, it's not intended to be funny, it just is.
Yeah, and you can laugh now that he is better, everything worked out okay.
Yeah, my son pooped it out, he was good. And, Bruce squeezed out a couple ones. He was good too.
He's good.
Now, wait, I want to talk to you. You just went through Cook Islands on yours, right?
Yeah, well, we actually, we've recorded them a long time ago, but we just put out Cook Islands.
Yeah, and I heard you didn't like that season all that much.
No, it wasn't my favorite of the seasons that we went back and watched. You know, I was excited about it because it was like, okay, you had Penner, you had Parvati, you have Ozzy, you have Candace, you have Yule. And I was really, really excited to go back and watch that. And I found it to be sort of a so-so season that I really loved. There's a, you know, the moment that the mutiny happens, that's sort of the inciting incident for a lot of drama that's going to get paid off at the merge. And I feel like the merge episode up until when Penner goes home, that's fantastic Survivor. But I feel like the beginning of the season and the end of the season, I feel like is a little bit boring.
I think you are one of the most diplomatic people I've ever heard calling that a so-so season. That is very noble of you.
But it's great. It really, really great. Those three episodes merge, and then the two episodes after. And Penner is great, but I do feel like Josh calls them. This is a lot of red shirts in that season. There are a lot of forgettable people along the way. And then Ozzy versus Yule is a good showdown. You have the guy who is really analytical versus the guy who's really great in the challenges. We do a lot worse in that final tribal council than Ozzy versus Yule in many of these seasons. But Becky, Sandra, there's a lot of people that you just forget about.
I was going to say, so for those of you who are scoring along at home, if there's a season with three good episodes out of 14 episodes, it is a so-so season.
Yeah.
I don't hate that season. I hate All Stars. All Stars is the only season I hate. Cook Islands is the only season I think is pointless.
Wow.
The entire first half of that season, there's nothing worth watching.
What is it so much that bothers you about it? Is it that they did the tribes divided by race?
It's not even that. That would have been interesting if they would have kept that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just when I was doing my research for the Funny 115 a couple years ago, like I would sit through entire episodes and not even write down one thing that was slightly funny, like for 5, 6, 7 straight episodes. I'm like, what the hell is this? Like in All Stars for the first or for Heroes versus Villains, the first season, I had like 25 different notes I took just on one episode. I would go like entire half of a season in Cook Islands and not even write one thing except, oh, Nate said something kind of funny here.
Yeah.
It's just pointless. The thing there's no entertainment value in that season up until the merge. And I agree with you. It gets pretty good once the merge hits and the finale where you have the best of the best, which rarely happens in Survivor, two people who really could win that season.
Yeah.
So that's neat. But man, is that season a chore to sit through. And I don't think a lot of people realize that because they haven't seen it recently.
And I'm a big Penner fan, so that certainly helps.
That's bollocks and you know it.
Mario, what are you talking about? It's a great season. It's one of the best seasons they've ever had.
I sure wish I had a Cook Islands impression that I could rebut that with.
Yeah. So it's not my favorite, but it's interesting to go back and take a look at it. You know, I've actually had a lot of fun in doing the rewatch of the seasons where I was kind of checked out of Survivor, where, you know, I don't know if it was to a degree that I was, but like I had a point in the middle portion of Survivor where I wasn't watching it on a week to week basis. And that's actually been kind of fun for me to go back in my rewatch to go back and pay attention to some of the stuff that I was like, I never talked about before.
Yeah. See, you're going through the exact same process I went through with the Funny 115 about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
When I went through and did my massive rewatch, because I remembered nothing about some of those seasons. And I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool. Like what season, if you could pick one, is way better on a rewatch than you remember it being?
I would say Guatemala.
Okay.
I enjoyed Guatemala because, again, some of these seasons that I've gone into with low expectations, like Cook Islands, I was like, oh, I'm looking forward to Cook Islands because I want to see Penner and Candace and Parvati, oh, Ozzy, and I was sort of let down. But the seasons that I kind of went into with no expectations of, like, Guatemala and Fiji also, which is coming up, that was another one where I kind of went into it with really low expectations, and then I was very excited about what I saw.
Yeah, I would agree with you about Fiji. The one that I loved when I saw it on a rewatch was Samoa, which I wasn't expecting at all.
Yeah.
So Samoa is one I think really improves when you kind of know how it ends before you watch it.
Yeah, I loved Samoa. I loved getting to go back in and rewatch Samoa. But I'm surprised. Do you just love it because you get to see how it goes wrong for Russell?
Of course.
Yeah. But I felt like that was a really fun conversation to have over, you know, knowing that Natalie is the winner from the beginning and that Russell is going to lose. It was a fun thing to sort of score that. Okay, what is Natalie doing? What is Russell doing?
Yeah, it is. But at the same time, I would say that Galoo, the Purple Tribe, Russell Swan's tribe.
Yeah.
They were fantastic. And that's something you don't notice until you watch the second time. How many fun characters are on that tribe?
Dave Ball is hilarious. Shambo is great TV. There is fun stuff that happens there.
Eric Cardona. Can't forget Eric.
Eric Cardona. I don't forget Eric Cardona.
Clothesline by the clothesline.
Clothesline by a clothesline. Yeah, so there is some good stuff there. There's a couple people that you just forget about also that are from that season. But that's also good stuff. All right. Talk to me about the funny 115 Volume 3. Because I felt like for a long time you said you were never going to do it. You recently decided that you were going to do it. Why the turnaround?
First off, I should say I always said there was never going to be a version 2 as well. So I tend to be very wishy-washy until something kicks my butt into action.
Yeah.
What happened with version 3 is it's all tied with my book. I wanted to get my book done. My book was sitting there on my shelf. I needed to do final edits. And I'm like, there's no incentive for me to get this done. And so one day I just thought, you know, if I announce that I'm going to do a funny 115, a third version, everyone will go crazy because they love that thing. So I'll announce that, everyone all of a sudden be excited about me again, and that'll be the incentive I need to write my book. I'm like, well, because I can't start the Funny 115 until I finish my book. So if people are bugging me and there's pressure on me to finish the book, I'll finally sit down and do it. So it was kind of a timing issue.
Yeah.
And then I also knew, I mean, Machiavellian, that, you know, if everyone's excited about the Funny 115, all of a sudden I have a readership for people who might be interested in my book that might not have known who I was 6 months ago.
And what's your process like for doing the Funny 115?
Basically, I just do a rewatch. I sit there with my wife, and she actually contributes a lot of the jokes. She's very helpful. We sit there, and we just watch the episodes, and we just look for the stuff that we think will be funny. And it's not necessarily like someone getting hit in the balls or someone falling down. You look for something that'll be a clever write-up, something that would be fun to do as a write-up. And so I'll make a big list, and then I'll go to Survivor Sucks. I'll go to POS, or I'll go anywhere on the internet on Facebook and kind of ask people what their nominees for these seasons are, if there's something maybe they think of that I wouldn't have thought of, if maybe someone has some esoteric idea for an entry that you wouldn't even think was funny, but is actually funny if you write it up and you think about it. So I get a lot of feedback from people. It's very interactive, and that's one thing that I don't think a lot of people know, that it's not just me saying, oh, here's the funny moments, accept them. I mean, it's very interactive. I work with people at Sucks. I get a lot of help from Sucks. They give me screenshots. They give me animated GIF files. So it's very interactive with about me, my wife, a couple of my close friends, people that I know are particularly bright and I trust their comedic instincts. I'll kind of draw them in on the side and ask for help with stuff. So there's a really long process. It's not as easy as you think it would be.
So you get the funny 115, and do you have like a bulletin board with index cards? Like, how do you do the order?
I'm very old school. I write stuff down on pieces of paper. I just have hundreds of little scraps of paper sitting around in my notebook, and I kind of keep them in there. And I kind of move them around to set, okay, this would be good here. Oh, I don't want two negative entries in a row. I want this one here. Oh, I don't want Tarzan to be in three entries within the same 10. I try to move them around. So it's trying to balance it out so it's not just a cluster of one person all in a row.
Do you know already what is going to be number one in the Funny 115 Volume 3?
I have a suspicion. It's not a slam dunk. I knew that Dead Grandma was number one on the first one. I knew that something involving Coach would be number one on the second one. There hasn't been a slam dunk in seasons 21 through 30 that's that obvious, but I have some suspicions. I don't want to spoil it. I've mentioned it in a couple other places, but I may change my mind. But I think I know it's number one, but it may change once I start getting some input from people.
All right. And then how do you announce the Funny 115? Do you do it like 10 at a time? Like, I don't remember from when you did the second one.
Yeah, I post them very slow. This is what annoys people, is that I post it as I write it. So I'll write one, it gets posted. The next day I'll look at it, I'm like, oh, that was pretty good. I'll look at the feedback to it. I may revise it a little bit. I may touch it up. I may add some pictures. And then if I feel like writing the next day, I'll add another one. Or sometimes I won't. Sometimes I'll go a week between entries. And this really annoys people, because my theory on writing stuff like this is I only care what it's going to look like in 10 years. I don't care what it looks like today. I think long term, but that annoys people because they come out so slow usually.
So you do one at a time?
I do one at a time, and I post it immediately after I write it. I mean, you're seeing rough draft. So you see my rough draft, it goes up, and I want to see people's reactions to it. And luckily, my rough drafts are usually passable for final entries, but every so often one just won't work, or it's wrong or there's a mistake in it. So I like to see people's immediate feedback before I even start the second entry.
So how long does it take you to get the whole funny 115 up? Does it take like a year?
It'll take a couple of months at minimum. It depends. It'll take me a couple months to research it, and it'll take me longer to write it and post it. And then I go through and I fine tune. And then, like, if someone really liked, if a lot of people loved entry number 80 and number 30 didn't really work that well, I might swap them later. Once I finish the whole thing, I'll move them around to their final order based on which ones I think work the best as a write-up.
And so you have like the list of what they're going to be from when you start. And then it's okay. Today is the day I have to write number 87.
Yeah.
And then you just go sit at the keyboard and just write straight to the page that it's ultimately going to be on.
Yeah. I just open up my HTML editor. I just start writing. And what's funny, a lot of people don't know this, is that, like I said, I'm a programmer. I have a 40-hour a week job, maybe longer, 50 hours a week sometimes. So I will only write at work if I can, but I don't do that as much as I used to. So almost everything I ever write when it comes to Survivor is like at 11 o'clock at night after everyone's gone to bed.
Mm-hmm.
So like I'm going to go through hell in about 4 or 5 months where I'm not sleeping. I'm staying up from 11 till 3 in the morning every night to write these entries and post them.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. But it's just wonder. I just write it. All right, that's pretty good. I'll post it. And then the next morning I'll wake up and see what people think about that entry.
And then does somebody else come in and put the pictures in and the GIFs and the GIFs and all that stuff?
Nope. I have to do all that. I have to go through when I'm researching. I have to go through and do all the screen captures. That takes forever because sometimes I'm looking for an exact pause of a screen for a facial reaction. So it takes forever to find these pictures. And then I have a couple people that do the moving GIF files that will, I'll ask them, hey, can you get a picture of Cat looking confused when she's looking at somebody, and they'll put it together. So I give them a specific request, and it's up to them if they can find it for me. So I have a lot of people that help me out.
And when you ask for a picture of Cat looking confused, does that make the job really hard? Because that, yeah. Which one?
It's actually relatively easy. They usually ask for more. I need more information, please.
Yeah. All right. So you got a ton of stuff going on here, Mark. And then tell me about the Reddit AMA. How was that?
The Reddit AMA was good. I've never been on Reddit. I know nothing. I'm your typical old person. Like, I know one way to do things. That's all I do. Like, I go to Survivor Sucks. I would still go to Survivor Central if it was there. I go to Facebook, and that's really all I know about Survivor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm aware of your podcast, but I don't really get involved in like who the guests are all the time and stuff. But like, I'm aware of what the main things are in Survivor. So I'm only aware of Reddit because I used to get hits for the funny 115 from Reddit. So I have no idea what the backstory of it is. I don't really know anything about it. So I had a friend there who's a moderator. He's like, hey, come do an AMA. You have a lot of fans here that love to hear about your process and like to hear about your book. I'm like, really? I'm like, am I popular there? He's like, well, you're hated too, but you're also popular. So it's one of those Dara answers. You know, he lies, but he tells the truth too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was fun. Basically, they throw about, you've done an AMA, right?
Yeah, a long time ago. I did an AMA before it was cool to do an AMA.
Yeah. See, now it's super cool. So I'm like, Fonz. But yeah, so I'm like, first off, I'm like, why do I even warrant an AMA? No one cares. She's like, oh no, just come. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
So basically, yeah, you get flooded with questions. There's like 50, 60 email questions and they all come in at once and you just sit there and type as fast as you can and try to answer as many as you can.
Yeah.
So it's kind of stressful. Like I'm trying to say exactly what I want to say, but I don't want to ramble. But then some answers I didn't give as much information as I should have. Like I left out some backstories. So the good news is I went in and I edited some of the answers later and I added more information to them. But it's kind of stressful because there's so much happening at once. And I was doing it in the middle of the workday, so I'm totally slacking and hoping no one notices.
Yeah. Next time I do it, I want to get like a stenographer here. And I just like, okay, answer this question. Boom, 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 boom. Okay, moving on. Let's keep going.
Yeah, ask Rob stenographer anything.
Yeah. I'm Rob Cisternino's stenographer, AMA.
Rob has a stenographer.
Yes. No, but what I like about Reddit is that it's sort of like, you know, everybody just does their own thing and they're just sort of like, all right, here's the bulletin board of like, here's everything that's happening that's interesting.
Yeah. It was fun. It's a little different culture than I'm used to. Like, there's a lot of Russell fans there and a lot of Spencer fans, and I tend not to be super high on either one of them. So I can get in a lot of fights real easy there. But it was a fun introduction to Reddit, and I hopefully I can do another one someday.
Why are you out on Spencer?
The thing with Spencer, and I've been saying this for years, or since he came around, I just don't buy his act. I don't buy that he's as big a super fan as he says he is. And I've always suspected that about him.
Hmm.
So it just bugs me that I think he's a kid playing a character on TV.
Now, is this because you're a big Cass fan?
I would be a big Cass fan regardless. But you can like Cass and Spencer. Like, I love Johnny Fairplay and Sandra and Pearl Islands. You can like them both.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't buy Spencer. I don't buy him as a character. And someday maybe he will change my mind. I just have never bought him as this big Survivor fan.
Yeah. I think that a big part of the appeal was also that he was up against Tony.
Yeah.
And I think that without Tony, I think that he would not have been as popular in that season.
Yeah, that's the thing, because he really wasn't that relevant to most of the season. He becomes relevant at times, but he's bouncing off characters. I've always said that's one of the reasons Sandra became a big character, because she had people that were fun she could bounce off. Like, she's bouncing insults off Johnny Fairplay. She's going against Russell. Like, if you have people you can bounce off that are fun characters, it makes you a better character.
Yeah. And if there is no big villain in season 31, or if we don't know who the villain that is going up against Spencer, it'll be interesting to see what his edit looks like there.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's one. They could completely turn me around on Spencer. It kind of depends on how he's presented. I just don't appreciate this. I'm a big super fan. I study the game. I don't like that character. So it's possible he could get a completely different edit and I'll do a 180 on him.
They could turn us around on any of these people.
Yeah. I used to hate you. No, I'm just kidding.
When
I was a big Rob fan, everyone knows I was one of the guys praising him at the time.
Yes.
But yeah. It is interesting that you can take Jerry Manthe.
Yeah. They turned you around you liked me and then they turned you around.
Yeah. Well, I've even started to like Parvati. I didn't always like Parvati, and now I'm a big Parvati fan. But to go back to my Jerry story, she's the same character in Heroes versus Villains as she is in Australia. But all of a sudden, she's a beloved hero who almost won this. So that's one thing I like to point out in my book and just in my writings in general, that Survivor characters are not the character you see on TV. They're presented in a specific way for a specific reason every time.
How do you think Steven's going to do this season?
I think he's got a big target on him, because I think think of him as this big genius. He's on a radio show now. You know, he does talk strategy. Oh, this guy knows everything about the game. I think he'll have a little more attention drawn at him this time than he had last time.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's not under JT's shadow. So he might do really well, but I do think he's going to get heat that he didn't have last time.
Yeah. It could go either way. I could see him having a lot of attention, but then I look at the people out there and say, who's really gunning for Steven out of these people?
Yeah, that's the one. What do you know about Tasha? We know Tasha's gameplay.
Yeah, but it's Tasha's like, oh, Steven Fishback, that's my number one target.
Exactly.
So,
but yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah, it's such a weird mix of people. We don't really know what they're going to think.
All right. I feel bad that we haven't given out the link yet for the book. I'm definitely going to have it in the description on the website as well. But where do you want people to go to get When It Was Worth Playing For?
The main place is you can just go to my website, funny115.com. I've completely covered up the Funny 115 and all I'm doing is whoring out my book now. So if you go to funny115.com, I give you several purchase options where you can get it, or you can just go right to amazon.com. again, even this, though this is a self-published book, it is available through Amazon. It goes through all their marketing channels. You can get it in Europe, you can get it in the US. So just go to funny115. It has all the information you need to know, and I will say I've had a lot of good feedback about it so far. People that read it, and they're getting exactly what I hoped that they would get out of it. They're saying, you know, this really takes me into what Survivor was like, what the experience was like at the time. And either they're there and it reminds them of that. Like, there's a lady, I don't know how to pronounce her name, Wezzy or Weezy, but she's an old school Survivor
fan.
She's reading it right now. And she's like, I love this book. I'm so into it. And I'm like, that's because you were there too. You totally understand how authentic this book is.
Yes.
So the people that I really want to get feedback from are giving me great feedback, and it's got some good reviews on Amazon. So it's one of those things that I think any Survivor fan would like to read, because, again, there aren't many Survivor books out there. I mean, anybody who knows a lot about the show, and you know this as well as anybody, the players aren't really allowed to write about Survivor. You're not allowed to write a book about what goes on behind the scenes, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There is never going to be a Survivor book by a player until long after the show is off the air. So the only people that can write about Survivor are the fans. It's either the fans or the producers. And to be honest, I wouldn't trust Jeff Probst's version of Survivor as far as I can throw it. So if you want a good recap of Survivor history, this may be the only book you're ever going to get about it. And that's one thing I like to stress over and over again, that the players aren't going to write books. So this may be the Survivor history book for a while.
All right. And don't forget about the Survivor Historians podcast. You can get that at funny115.com/podcast.
Yep. Or iTunes. iTunes has it for free.
That's right. You can get it so many places for free. What a deal.
If you would like to listen to a podcast with 1/100th the listenership of Rob Has a Podcast, listen to Survivor Historians.
No, people love his Survivor Historians. It's a lot of fun. They're up to Survivor Panama at this point in time. They just dropped the middle portion called Pooper slash Not a Pooper.
Yeah, we dropped a deuce, if you will.
And there it is.
Yeah, well, one thing I wanted to say, a lot of people compare our shows. They say, oh, the evolutionist strategy is just for historians, or historians is just the same thing as Rob's. But Rob and I are so similar, and we have such a similar background to the show. Like, you can hear us talking. We have a lot of the same stories about survivors. So inevitably, our projects are going to have some overlap, but there's room in the world for both of them. And we try not to compare them. We're doing different things, and we're both having fun with it. So hopefully people just don't compare, and they're not the same show. They're totally different.
Well, here's the thing about the comparisons between the evolutionist strategy that I'm doing with Josh and then what you guys are doing on the Survivor Historians. Nobody that's ever listened to both has ever compared them. The only people that ever make comparisons are people that haven't listened to one of them.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And that's, you know, that's the thing. If you listen to both of them, you might get different things out of both. Look, you're going to learn more about the seasons either way. So that's the thing. Rob and I have always been friends. We're not competitive. We totally understand each other's projects. And that's just the way it is. We've always been buddies like that.
Yeah, and whatever I can do to help you with whatever you're doing, happy to do it, Mario.
I appreciate you having me on to talk about the book. Because again, I'm very proud of this book, and everyone I think would like it.
All right, and don't forget to check out Previously on Survivor as well if you're not there. What's the initiation process on Previously on Survivor?
The initiation process is you request to join the group, and we look at you to make sure you're not a fake account that wasn't joined Facebook 2 days ago and belongs to 95 groups already. And if you can pass that and you have a face, we will let you in the group. So it's a very strict process.
You need a face avatar.
Yes, we'll go back to the Jerry Seinfeld how to get a taxi license. All you need is a face and a name with like 8 consonants in a row.
All right, so if I have it, my picture is my cat. Can I get in?
50-50.
50-50.
It better be one sexy cat.
It's suspect. All right. Mario, thank you so much. And definitely go check it out. Funny115.com to get the books, and looking forward to hearing what people have to say in the comments as well.
Absolutely. Sounds good. And again, if people like this one, I'm totally going to do a sequel. This is supposed to be part one of a series of books. So if you like it, please write me a positive review somewhere on Amazon, and that will help go a long way.
All right, Mario, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rob.
All right, everybody, there you have it. There is Mario Lanza here on the podcast talking about everything going on with When It Was Worth Playing For. So much more coming up this week on the podcast. We're going to do a very special Big Brother podcast. I haven't announced this yet. We are going to cast a season of Big Brother Second Chance. That's going to be live on Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. It's going to be a lot of fun. And then we're going to be with The Tabulator, and our friend from Big Brother Canada, Jordan Parhar, is going to join us to cast a season of Big Brother Second Chance. And the best part about this is we are going to just cast the list of people that you are going to get to vote for. So we are going to cast a list of people, and then we are going to let you vote on your cast for Big Brother Second Chance. That's going to be a lot of fun. Plus, I'm going to get together with Nicole for our 25 Questions podcast, which is going to be coming up later in the week as well. So a lot to do here on Rob Has a Podcast. So looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say in the comments. Make sure you don't miss an episode by subscribing at robisawebsite.com/iTunes. And we'll talk to you again soon. Take care, everybody. Bye.